Chapter 22. Himself, is it filled, but a short and small fragment of time, an ephemeral season which would have been well-nigh imperceptible, even to him, at this distance, but for the incident it enshrined. One day, at this date, when cursorily glancing over an old English newspaper, he observed a paragraph which, short as it was, contained for him whole tomes of thrilling information run with more passion-stirring rhythm than the collected cantos of all the poets. It was an announcement of the death of the Duke of Hamptonshire, leaving behind him a widow, but no children. The current of Alwyn's thoughts now completely changed. On looking again at the newspaper, he found it to be one that was sent him long ago, and had been carelessly thrown aside. But for an accidental overhauling of the waste journals in his study, he might not have known of the event for years. At this moment of reading, the Duke had already been dead 7 months. Alwyn could now no longer bind himself down to machine-made synecdoche, antithesis, and climax, being full of spontaneous specimens of all these rhetorical forms, which he dared not utter. Who shall wonder that his mind luxuriated in dreams of a sweet possibility now laid open for the first time these many years? For Emmeline was to him now as ever the one dear thing in all the world. The issue of his silent romancing was that he resolved to return to her at the very earliest moment. But he could not abandon his professional work on the instant. He did not get really quite free from engagements till 4 months later. But, though suffering throes of impatience continually, he said to himself every day, "If as he has continued to love me 9 years, she will love me 10, she will think the more tenderly of me, when her present hours of solitude shall have done their proper work, old times will revive with the cessation of her recent experience, and every day will favor my return." The enforced interval soon passed, and he duly arrived in England, reaching the village of Batton on a certain winter day between 12 and 13 months subsequent to the time of the Duke's death. It was evening, yet such was Alwyn's impatience, that he could not forbear taking, this very night, one look at the castle which Emmeline had entered as unhappy mistress 10 years before. He threaded the park trees, gazed in passing at well-known outlines which rose against the dim sky, and was soon interested in observing that lively country people, in parties of 2 and 3, were walking before and behind him up the interlaced avenue to the castle gateway. Knowing himself to be safe from recognition, Alwyn inquired of one of these pedestrians what was going on. "Her Grace gives her tenantry a ball tonight, to keep up the old custom of the Duke and his father before him, which she does not wish to change." Indeed. "Has she lived here entirely alone since the Duke's death?" Quite alone. "But though she doesn't receive company herself, she likes the village people to enjoy themselves, and often has them here." Kind-hearted, as always. Thought Alwyn. On reaching the castle, he found that the great gates at the tradesman's entrance were thrown back against the wall, as if they were never to be closed again, that the passages and rooms in that wing were brilliantly lighted up, some of the numerous candles guttering down over the green leaves which decorated them, and upon the silk dresses of the happy farmers' wives as they passed beneath, each on her husband's arm. Alwyn found no difficulty in marching in along with the rest, the castle being Liberty Hall tonight. He stood unobserved in a corner of the large apartment, where dancing was about to begin. "Her Grace, though hardly out of mourning, will be sure to come down and lead off the dance with Neighbor Bates," said one. "Who is Neighbor Bates?" Asked Alwyn. "An old man she respects much, the oldest of her tenant farmers. He was 78 his last birthday." "To be sure." Said Alwyn, at his ease. "I remember." The dancers formed in line, and waited. A door opened at the farther end of the hall, and a lady in black silk came forth. She bowed, smiled, and proceeded to the top of the dance. "Who is that lady?" " said Alwyn, in a puzzled tone. "I thought you told me that the Duchess of Hamptonshire " said his informant. "But there is another?"
"No, there is no other.
But she is not the Duchess of Hamptonshire who used to Alwyn's tongue stuck to his mouth. He could get no farther. "What's the matter?"
" said his acquaintance.
Alwyn had retired, and was supporting himself against the wall. The wretched Alwyn murmured something about a stitch in his side from walking. Then the music struck up, the dance went on, and his neighbor became so interested in watching the movements of this strange duchess through its mazes, as to forget Alwyn for a while. It gave him an opportunity to brace himself up. He was a man who had suffered, and he could suffer again. How came that person to be your duchess? " he asked in a firm, distinct voice, when he had attained complete self-command. "Where is her other Grace of Hamptonshire?"
"There certainly was another. I know it.
The previous one."
"Yes, yes.
She ran away years and years ago with the young curate. Mr. Hill was the young man's name, if I recollect."
"
She never did."
"What do you mean by that?"
" he said.
"Yes, she certainly ran away. She met the curate in the shrubbery about a couple of months after her marriage with the Duke. There were folks who saw the meeting, and heard some words of their talk. They arranged to go, and she sailed from Plymouth with him a day or two afterward."
"That's not true."
"Then 'tis the queerest lie ever told by man. Her father believed, and knew to his dying day, that she went with him, and so did the Duke, and everybody about here.
There was a fine upset about it at the time. The Duke traced her to Plymouth."
"Traced her to Plymouth?"
"He traced her to Plymouth, and set on his spies. And they found that she went to the shipping office, and inquired if Mr. Alwyn Hill had entered his name as passenger by the Western Glory, and when she found that he had, she booked herself for the same ship, but not in her real name. When the vessel had sailed, a letter reached the Duke from her, telling him what else he had done. She never came back here again. His Grace lived by himself a number of years, and married this lady only 12 months before he died."
Alwyn was in a state of indescribable bewilderment. But, unmanned as he was, he called the next day on the, to him, spurious Duchess of Hamptonshire. At first she was alarmed at his statement, then cold, then she was won over by his condition, to give confidence for confidence. She showed him a letter which had been found among the papers of the late Duke, corroborating what Alwyn's informant had detailed. It was from Emmeline, bearing the postmark date at which the Western Glory sailed, and briefly stated that as he had emigrated by that ship to America. Alwyn applied himself body and mind to unravel the remainder of the mystery. The story repeated to him was always the same. She ran away with the curate. A strangely circumstantial piece of intelligence was added to this, when he had pushed his inquiries a little further. There was given him the name of a waterman at Plymouth, who had come forward at the time that she was missed and sought for by her husband, and had stated that he put her on board the Western Glory at dusk one evening before that vessel sailed. After several days of search about the alleys and quays of Plymouth Barbican, during which these impossible words, "She ran off with the curate," became branded on his brain, Alwyn found this important waterman. He was positive as to the truth of his story, still remembering the incident well, and he described in detail the lady's dress, as he had long ago described it to her husband, which description corresponded in every particular with the dress worn by Emmeline on the evening of their parting. Before proceeding to the other side of the Atlantic, to to continue his inquiries there, the puzzled and distracted Alwyn set himself to ascertain the address of Captain Wheeler, who had commanded the Western Glory in the year of Alwyn's voyage out, and immediately wrote a letter to him on the subject. The only circumstances which the sailor could recollect or discover from his papers in connection with such a story were, that a woman bearing the name which Alwyn had mentioned as fictitious certainly did come aboard for a voyage he made about that time, that she took a common berth among the poorest emigrants, that she died on the voyage out, at about 5 days' sail from Plymouth, that she seemed a lady in manners and education. Why, he had not applied for a first-class passage, why, he had no trunks, they could not guess, for though he had little money in her pocket, he had that about her which would have fetched it. We buried her at sea, continued the captain. A young parson, one of the cabin passengers, read the burial service over her, I remember well. The whole scene and proceedings darted upon Alwyn's recollection in a moment. It was a fine breezy morning on that long past voyage out, and he had been told that they were running at the rate of 100-odd miles a day. The news went round that one of the poor young women in the other part of the vessel was ill of fever and delirious. The tidings caused no little alarm among all the passengers, for the sanitary conditions of the ship were anything but satisfactory. Shortly after this, the doctor announced that she had died. Then Alwyn had learned that she was laid out for burial in great haste, because of the danger that would have been incurred by delay. And next the funeral scene rose before him, and the prominent part that he had taken in that solemn ceremony. The captain had come to him, requesting him to officiate, as there was no chaplain on board. This he had agreed to do, and as the sun went down with a blaze in his face, he read amidst them all assembled, "We therefore commit her body to the deep, to be turned into corruption, looking for the resurrection of the body, when the sea shall give up her dead." The captain also forwarded the addresses of the ship's matron, and of other persons who had been engaged on board at the date. To these Alwyn went in the course of time. A categorical description of the clothes of the dead truant, the color of her hair, and other things, extinguished forever all hope of a mistaken identity. At last, then, the course of events had become clear. On that unhappy evening, when he left Emmeline in the shrubbery, forbidding her to follow him, because it would be a sin, she must have disobeyed. She must have followed at his heels silently through the darkness, like a poor pet animal that will not be driven back. She could have accumulated nothing for the journey more than she might have carried in her hand, and thus poorly provided she must have embarked. Her intention had doubtless been to make her presence on board known to him as soon as she could muster courage to do so. Thus the 10 years chapter of Alwyn Hill's romance wound itself up under his eyes. That the poor young woman in the steerage had been the young Duchess of Hamptonshire was never publicly disclosed. Hill had no longer any reason for remaining in England, and soon after left its shores with no intention to return. Previous to his departure, he confided his story to an old friend from his native town, grandfather of the person who now relates it to you. A few members, including the bookworm, seemed to be impressed by the quiet gentleman's tale, but the member we have called the Spark, who, by the way, was getting somewhat tinged with the light of other days, and owned to 8-and-30, walked daintily about the room instead of sitting down by the fire with the majority, and said that for his part he preferred something more lively than the last story, something in which such long separated lovers were ultimately united. He also liked stories that were more modern in their date of action than those he had heard today. Members immediately requested him to give them a specimen, to which the Spark replied that he didn't mind, as far as that went. And though the vice president, the man of family, the colonel, and others, looked at their watches, and said they must soon retire to their respective quarters in the hotel adjoining, they all decided to sit out the Spark's story. Dame the TENTH, the Honorable Laura by the Spark, It was a cold and gloomy Christmas Eve. The mass of cloud overhead was almost impervious to such daylight as still lingered on. The snow lay several inches deep upon the ground, and the slanting downfall which still went on threatened to considerably increase its thickness before the morning. The Prospect Hotel, a building standing near the wild north coast of Lower Wessex, looked so lonely and so useless at such a time as this that a passing wayfarer would have been led to forget summer possibilities and to wonder at the commercial courage which could invest capital on the basis of the popular taste for the picturesque in a country subject to such dreary phases. That the district was alive with visitors in August seemed but a dim tradition in weather so totally opposed to all that tempts mankind from home. However, there the hotel stood immovable, and the cliffs, creeks, and headlands which were the primary attractions of the spot, rising in full view on the opposite side of the valley, were now but stern angular outlines, while the townlet in front was tinged over with a grimy dirtiness, rather than the pearly gray that in summer lent such beauty to its appearance. Within the hotel commanding this outlook, the landlord walked idly about with his hands in his pockets, not in the least expectant of a visitor, and yet unable to settle down to any occupation which should compensate in some degree for the losses that winter idleness entailed on his regular profession. So little, indeed, was anybody expected, that the coffee room waiter, a genteel boy, whose plated buttons in summer were as close together upon the front of his short jacket as peas in a pod, now appeared in the backyard, metamorphosed into the unrecognizable shape of a rough country lad in corduroys and hobnailed boots, sweeping the snow away, and talking the local dialect in all its purity, quite oblivious of the new polite accent he had learned in the hot weather from the well-behaved visitors. The front door was closed, and, as if to express still more fully the sealed and chrysalis state of the establishment, a sandbag was placed at the bottom to keep out the insidious snowdrift, the wind setting in directly from that quarter. The landlord, entering his own parlor, walked to the large fire which it was absolutely necessary to keep up for his comfort, no such blaze burning in the coffee room or elsewhere, and after giving it a stir returned to a table in the lobby, whereon lay the visitor's book now closed and pushed back against the wall. He carelessly opened it. Not a name had been entered there since the 19th of the previous November, and that was only the name of a man who had arrived on a tricycle, who, indeed, had not been asked to. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.